The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
What you're trying to do is balance analytical utility in terms of getting an answer to the question with contextual realism and trying to get all of the elements of the scenario that you're interested in, whether that be a problem around climate change or a business decision, right? Do you invest, do you not? Or do you buy a particular weapon system or do you not?
It's the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Natalie Orpett, Executive Editor of Lawfare, introducing a conversation between our managing editor, Tyler McBrien, and Andrew Reddy, Associate Research Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the founder and faculty director of the Berkeley Risk and Security Lab.
Particularly where you have problems that you don't have empirical data for, you're going to need to figure out new ways to create synthetic data that look a little bit different than computer-based modeling and simulation that are fundamentally limited by the assumptions that you're having to make about human behavior.
Tyler and Andrew spoke about wargaming as a tool to manage risk from war to climate and beyond.
So, Andrew, I think a lot of our listeners will already be familiar with the concept of wargaming, but just so we're all on the same page, I want to start with a definitional question. So when we're talking about wargames in this conversation today, what are we talking about?
Well, we're actually talking about a wide variety of methods that we effectively used to engage with challenging situations, whether they be crisis and security contexts or strategic planning and business contexts. What sets wargaming apart from some of its alternatives, whether they be computer-based modeling and simulation or survey experiments as a synthetic data generating tool, is that what you're trying to do is to create a scenario in which players, either in single teams or working at cross purposes against another team, have a really hard problem that they're trying to engage with. And whilst they're inside of our environment, they're making decisions that matter. So there's consequential decision-making. There's a little bit of strategic interaction, whether it's against the scenario or another team. And that ultimately we're kind of carrying forward that scenario over time, whether that game lasts for a few hours, a full day, a week in some cases, even longer, and really try to get to grips with that really hard strategic problem.
Great. And before we get into some of the really interesting history and applications and design questions of war games, I want to mention, of course, to our listeners that you have launched a mini-series podcast for your podcast Risk Calculus at the Berkeley Risk and Security Lab. What motivated this podcast series? Why wargaming, and why make a podcast about it?
So I think one of the things that we're really excited about in the academic space is moving what has been a conversation that's traditionally occurred in Washington amongst the defense community and the FFRDCs, whether they be RAND Corporation or MITRE or the Center for Naval Analysis, and then more recently the think tanks like CSIS, and really think hard about how to leverage some of these wargaming tools in academic contexts, both to try to improve the ways in which wargames are used in policymaking, but also to think about how they might be used in a research context. And because that research context is so new, one of the things that we're trying to do is situate our students that are rising in the field to kind of understand kind of where these methods came from and what they can subsequently be useful for. And so, bless my students, I think that sometimes engaging with multimedia like podcasts, YouTube videos, et cetera, can be a much easier way to kind of grapple with a new concept rather than having to read an academic journal article, actually particularly an academic journal article. And so that was kind of what really drove the push towards thinking about creating something in this medium as kind of a really quick 101 for students to be able to pick up. And of course, I think one of the things that makes that series a little bit different is that it is so academically oriented with, you know, amazing speakers like Reed Pauley from Brown University, John Emery from Oklahoma, Jackie Schneider from Stanford, Bethany, my colleague at Berkeley, and then Ellie Bartel is kind of representing that practitioner perspective from RAND. But we really were really focused on those kind of academic applications and thinking about what the university setting has to add to this conversation. And so that was really what was driving us creating this particular series.
Yeah, that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you. I really love the podcast. I thought it was really, even though you said it has an academic focus for academic applications, it was really accessible and engaging and sort of demystifying wargaming. I think, you know, some people can have this idea of a Dr. Strangelove type setting with a big map on the table, but there's a lot more to it, as you were hinting at in the beginning. So could you take us through just a bit of history of wargaming? I know it's a very long, centuries maybe old history. But in your mind, what are the, you know, what are the, some of the high points of the history of wargaming?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a terribly long history, and it goes back, you know, even longer than we actually end up discussing in the series. You see examples of effectively what are war games for both military training and then also just leisure, going back over 3,000 years. Of course, some of the games that we live with today, whether they be Go or chess, kind of really come out of that milieu. But really, wargaming in the way that we kind of think about it in the U.S. and defense context today, we have a lot to thank the Germans for. And so in the mid-1800s, von Moltke, among various others, were really thinking about ways to try to educate their military strategists and generals such that they didn't require so much central oversight. And really, one of the things that was a good predictor of victory on the battlefield was that flexibility that was given to generals. And so it became a really useful tool for that, both education piece and then also thinking through really hard strategic problems. And so you saw the development of various different types of war games. As I mentioned, you know, war games can take the form of a board, like you just mentioned, but they can also take the form of effectively like a little storybook. And that's something that we saw in that German case, where basically there were problem sets that German officers were asked to kind of play and think through as part of their training. And then that subsequently they would carry with them onto the battlefield. And of course, Prussia was terribly successful during this period. And so you effectively had various different copycats across the globe. And so the German innovations in the wargaming space travel to the United Kingdom, and you see various different wargaming societies at places like the University of Oxford. And then McCarty Little from the United States, while traveling through Europe, ends up taking the method back to the Naval War College. And really, the Naval War College is the major driver of the use of these tools in our military here in the United States, starting in the very early 1900s. And of course, it becomes something that our own naval strategists in particular really pick up and use, and is credited with our various successes, particularly in World War II. There's a very famous apocryphal quote from General Nimitz, who actually formed the ROTC program at Berkeley. And he was alleged to have said that nothing that the Japanese did in the Pacific theater was a surprise, with the exception of the kamikaze pilots. All the rest of it had been modeled during various different war games across the 1920s. One interesting historical tidbit from that period is that actually the Naval War College was modeling against the Japanese in the Pacific theater, and was actually modeling against the UK, the British, in the Atlantic theater. And that wasn't necessarily because they were expecting to go to war against the Brits. It was because the Brits had the largest navy at the of the period. And so subsequently, the U.S. was trying to think about how to address a fairly well-endowed naval force. And of course, as you're thinking about all of the new technologies that were coming into the military during that period of time, whether it's fighter aircraft, bomber aircraft, submarines, and then obviously anti-submarine warfare, war games were a really integral piece to kind of figuring out both how to develop and use those tools, and then also how to counter them. There's very famous stories of actually during World War II and the various different attempts to deal with the U-boat problem among the British. where they stood up a really significant gaming capability in Liverpool, and that ended up being terribly successful in turning the tide in the Battle of the Atlantic. And of course, if the Battle of the Atlantic had moved a slightly different way, you know, things might look very different in that particular conflict. And then fast forwarding just a little bit during the Cold War, that's where we see the beginnings of a lot of the war games that we do today. And so the likes of the RAND Corporation, Thomas Schelling at MIT, they pick up this method and start using it for strategic level questions and really were interested in the conduct of the Cold War, whether they be proxy conflicts in Korea and Vietnam to kind of broader U.S. meets USSR in places like Germany and the European theater. And that really kind of opens up the aperture for a lot of the things that we still do today in terms of, you know, wargaming, Taiwan Straits crises, Baltic Sea scenarios, etc. But I will say again, this particular method applies to any particular strategic challenge that an institution might have, not just in security context. And so we see you know, a lot of examples of these tools used in business. Shell Oil have a very famous scenario analysis, wargaming capability that they used to come out of the oil crisis in the 1970s fairly well with. You also see those types of things happening as well. And really what's made things exciting in the field over the last decade or so now, Bob Work released a memo basically doubling down on the need for us to make sure that our wargaming community is, you know, stays robust, particularly in an era of strategic competition. And so you saw a doubling down amongst the think tanks and the FFRDCs in this space. And then also some, you know, some folks like myself and Jackie, Ericlin Greenberg at MIT, thinking about, well, if we were using these tools in defense contexts, how can we start using them in academic ones? And so it's, you know, it's a long history and it's an important history to kind of understand where we're coming from. But I think one of the things that we're also trying to do is make sure that these tools continue to get better moving forward.
There's a lot to dig into there. But before we move on from the history lesson, I want to make sure that we touch on one of the quirkier, I think, historical vignettes that we've talked about, actually, in which war games were promoted not only to inform decisions with war, but rather to replace war entirely. I'm talking, as you know, of H.G. Wells' strange book, Little Wars.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about that?
I mean, ultimately, there's a couple of different ways to think about conflict, right? Like even in the more contemporary literature that's moved on significantly from H.G. Wells, you have, you know, various conversations about the bargaining model of war and ultimately why we ought to be fighting when we, you know, if we have good information about an adversary's capabilities and resolve and they have the same about us, ultimately we should be able to come to some sort of deal. And so the base idea is that you can kind of simulate these conflicts, figure out where they're going to land, and then effectively end them via some sort of settlement without the loss of blood and treasure. And so, you know, that's a little bit Pollyannish, but, you know, certainly is something that, you know, continues to kind of exist in theory. But I will say from the academic side of it, and what we're the most interested in is not kind of the optimal playing out of a particular conflict and scenario. It's more about trying to put the human being in the crisis situation and really understanding how they react to the various different scenarios that they're ultimately given. Because I think one of the things that we've observed in particularly government contexts over the last 30 years is a wish to simulate, model, you know, various different outcomes as if the human is this kind of perfectly rational individual, which doesn't really reflect the ways in which humans actually behave, which, you know, any of us that have locked ourselves out of our house or misplaced our car keys will understand. You know, your heartbeat rises, you make decisions that are a little bit irrational. You know, ultimately, we're trying to create environments where the human really is central and you're not kind of just playing through.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the mechanics of actually designing and building a war game or, you know, some sort of risk-based scenario and then actually playing it out. Could you give some examples of how this works in practice, not only in the defense or military way, but in some of the other ways, you know, perhaps climate-related war games or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that ultimately I have a perspective that I share with some of my academic colleagues about how to do this appropriately. So for us, wargaming methods are an analytical endeavor. You know, we're not using them to rubber stamp a decision that's already been made elsewhere. We really are trying to get new insight from the particular gaming environment, or you're using it for pedagogical purposes to teach. In both cases, really the research question that you have is what's going to be driving your design. And so anytime that you have a phenomenon of interest and various different, you know, what we would call in social science terms, variables, right? Independent variables that are going to be driving the variation in that outcome, that's what you're going to be designing around. Once you have your research design solid, you've kind of understood what it is that you might want to vary, you might not want to vary, then it becomes a question of kind of scaffolding your scenario. So for example, do you want to have a game that uses real-world country names, or do you want to try to abstract that away? That's a design choice that has a lot of downstream consequences. If I make a game that is blue versus red, where the red player thinks that they're modeling a Russia or a China, I'm going to have players that are effectively caricaturing what they think, right, Beijing might do or Moscow might do. But if I build a game that is orange, purple, green, I get to align some of that confound against my strategic problem set. And other types of design decisions, right? Do I want to have the board, right, that you mentioned before? Do I want to have a map? Do I need it? Do I want to have cards and dice, right, to really kind of build the world in which your players are ultimately engaging? The way that I describe the game design process comes from an article that I've been writing with a colleague, Ruby Booth, at Sandia National Labs. And the way that we kind of think about game design is that what you're trying to do is balance analytical utility in terms of getting an answer to the question with contextual realism and trying to get all of the elements of the scenario that you're interested in, whether that be a problem around climate change or a business decision, right? Do you invest, do you not? Or do you buy a particular weapon system or do you not? Like, what are all the things that need to be in there to make this feel real for my player? And then finally, engaging play. Is it actually something that a player can pick up and engage with and play within a fairly short period of time? One of the things that's definitely an imperfect science for us at this point is really figuring out how complex we can make these games while allowing players to kind of pick them up and play. I mean, to give you an example of what this sometimes looks like in some of these contexts is that, like, we'll write novels and players will often read those novels to get in their role for the game while they're flying out to, you know, the game location. And it requires all of that kind of preparation for them to actually play. But obviously, you know, there's other games that you want people to be playing within 5 minutes. And so those are going to look much more like Settlers of Catan or Ticket to Ride or Risk or any of the other games that you might have seen in your kind of daily life. And so, you know, those design decisions really do need to kind of be balanced against one another, engaging play, analytical utility, contextual realism. And we have lots of tools at our disposal to kind of build those environments now. We can build these environments online. One of our, you know, fairly well-known games is Signal, which is a nuclear game that was deployed on a browser. It also exists as a board game. You know, we have games that are entirely seminar-based where you're putting scenarios up for the various teams on a PowerPoint and having, you know, pretty hard conversations about what it is that you're going to do given that particular scenario. And then you can collect those orders and then move the game forward using a white cell. So all of those kind of, all that scaffolding follows from that kind of research question forward. The problem that I think a lot of the academics have observed in this space when we reflect on the ways that these games are being used elsewhere is that oftentimes what happens is you have a stakeholder that says, you know, I want to look at the Baltic Sea. And so you build an environment that approximates the Baltic Sea in some important way, but there's no question that lies behind it. It's just, hey, show me, right, what this particular scenario might look like. And so, you know, it can be a little bit aimless and not necessarily pegged to a particular question. And so one of the things that we as academics are trying to do in this space is really kind of move the needle forward in terms of making sure that all designers are really thinking hard about what the game is for and then designing around that. So just to give an example of where kind of the research question influences a game mechanic, if I am to use a lot of dice in a game, it can make the game a lot of fun. you know, dialing up some chance. But analytically, it's actually quite hard because when I dial up the stochasticity that's introduced with a dice, I'm less able to collect data on what the players actually want to do because their performing an action is going to be mediated by a dice roll. And so generally speaking, when we're collecting data on games, we want less and less kind of stochasticity introducing tools. And so, you know, really, you do you have to make sure that form follows function in this case.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What are some other design flaws that you've seen? I know you mentioned, you know, just now the sort of aimlessness of walking into a war game or designing one without a defined question. You also mentioned earlier an assumption of rationality can sometimes lead to different outcomes. What are other design flaws that you've seen that you're trying to correct for as you push the needle forward?
I think the most pernicious is really sponsorship bias. And so where you've got games that are being built not for their analytical applications, but more for their kind of rubber stamping a policy decision that's already been made. And so that's something that obviously as an academic and an analyst, you're really trying to push against. You know, if you're going to be using an analytical tool and pretending that there have, you know, that it has analytical heft, then you need to use it as such. And I think there are a large number of us that have been a part of games where we kind of have seen the twisting of the game towards, you know, a particular sponsor's preferences, which, you know, ultimately that's to some extent that's got a lot to do with the kind of the milieu of sponsor pushing into, you know, the think tank or the FFRDC that's building a game and then subsequently trying to map on what it is that you think your sponsor might want. And so I think when sponsors are asking for war games, we need to make sure that they're educated insofar as, you know, you may get a finding that you weren't necessarily expecting, and that's still useful for you. So that's one of the things that we're really kind of pushing against. But I think one of the other things that was happening inside of the wargaming community was a lot of games that were designed to be quote unquote experiential and to provide an opportunity for senior policymakers to engage with a particular scenario of interest were subsequently being used as if they were analytical. And so you would have a game that was, you know, designed for example, an incoming Secretary of State. And it would perform the role that it needs to, which is really situating that secretary to their roles, responsibilities, even their movements during a crisis. And indeed, that's another apocryphal quote of Condi Rice during 9/11, where she said, one of the really nice things about the wargaming that I had done prior to 9/11 was that I understood, you know, obviously they weren't modeling a scenario that was even remotely approximated 9/11, but she knew exactly where it was that she would be taken and who it was that she would be talking to. And she said that was very useful. So that experiential use case is really important. But the problem comes in when you start saying things like, well, during the game, I saw this really interesting outcome, and therefore I think that a conflict with China is going to play out in a particular way. Because on the basis of 1N, you can't really tell me anything meaningful about outcomes. And, you know, recently we've had a big conversation in the field emanating from a few think tank games that made a lot of news around casualties in a particular conflict context. And ultimately, when you're only playing a game once, it's very hard to tell, you know, is that the highest number of casualties possible? Is that a floor? is that the modal or the mean, really you're not kind of getting there. And so one of the other things that's happening in the academic space, they're really trying to play these games tens of times, hundreds of times, potentially thousands of times, such that you're actually going to be able to capture the distribution over whatever problem set that you're actually interested in, and start to apply some of the standards of experimentation to this tool that has traditionally been used in kind of one-shot orientations. Now, of course, playing games multiple times comes with its own problems, not least that you're not always going to have the sample that you're going to want to have. So there's certainly a disagreement in the field about who ought to be playing games of different types. I'm fairly sympathetic to the perspective that you're going to want to have people playing your games that are close corollaries to those that are, you know, that are dealing with the problem inside of your game day to day. But on the flip side, you're not going to get, you know, a 3-star general to play 100 iterations of a war game, right? That's not reasonable. You're not going to get an undersecretary of defense, right, to play a war game 100 times. We have to kind of figure out what the Goldilocks amount of kind of movement away from having only elite play, if you will, against trying to get some of that increased data flow that you can really start to use to get some analytical heft behind your findings. So, you know, those are the types of debates that we're having that are very much alive.
So just to draw out that distinction a bit more, the one I think you're making, what should a player walk away with from a well-designed war game? And then similarly, ideally, how would that player then apply it to decision-making, you know, in the field once they're back in the real world?
So in the best case, you're really trying to build an environment that, again, is not going to approximate one-for-one the challenge of their daily job. But you do want to force them into challenging situations that are akin to those that are faced in their day-to-day job. I mean, one of the major challenges that we have in the U.S. with our political appointee structure is that you've got individuals walking into roles in, you know, the January following the election, and they are not steeped inside of that particular bureaucracy and have to get up to speed very, very quickly. And in my view, there's very few tools better than a war game or wargaming methods or scenario methods to get them up to speed as quickly as possible. So again, in the Condi Rice example, you're not necessarily going to have her play through a scenario that involved a terrorist hijacking of an airplane, but you probably were playing through various different types of attacks on the U.S. homeland that built off of the Oklahoma City bombing case, for example, or maybe some of the prior attacks that we'd had on various embassies with the USS Cole bombing. And so you're using real-world historical corollaries, building an artificial environment for the policymaker to play through and have that be really useful in terms of, you know, what is the information that you need in order to make decisions? Do you feel comfortable making decisions under, you know, pretty significant time constraints and also uncertainty? Those are the kind of the things that you really do want your players to walk away with in that particular type of context. Now, if I'm designing a game against a research question, I sometimes care a little bit less about what my players are walking away from and care more about what I'm learning. But on the flip side, if I have a game that is not real, quote unquote, to the player, then the data that I'm deriving from that game isn't particularly useful. So, you know, almost all of us are trying to make sure that we're driving up that engaging play as much as we possibly can.
One of the only times that I see war games often make headlines or loom large in the public imagination is when some of these more doom and gloom scenarios come up. So I'm thinking specifically of, I think, a few months ago when there were headlines that in the Taiwan Straits example,
yeah,
the U.S. is ill-prepared to defend Taiwan in, you know, the case of an invasion, or there would be mass casualties. What does the media get wrong and similarly get right about war games? I'm interested in these misperceptions that you've been correcting so far. What are some others that you can think of?
Well, I think there's, I mean, obviously the media is going to be, they'll fall victim even more perhaps than our, you know, our think tank and FFRDC colleagues to the kind of the one-shotness. The headline from that particular game, I believe that the number was 30,000 casualties in the event of a Taiwan Straits crisis. And of course, very quickly on places like I think it was still Twitter then, I'm not sure. Right, you had people saying that number is way too low, and then other people saying that number is way too high. And really the answer is like, hey, look, I need to play the game thousands of times more to figure out kind of what this particular game design is going to yield by way of civilian casualties or the likelihood of being able to defend Taiwan or not. And so I think that, you know, they're certainly falling victim to that kind of one-shotness. There's also a lack of appreciation for the degree to which your player pool and your game design is going to be driving that particular outcome. And that's really why you want to try to be playing these games more than once if you possibly can. Because I could have played the same game that CNAS put together with an entirely different set of players, and maybe things look slightly different. I could have played it with, and that's the blue side. And, you know, if we're ever to play a different red cell, right, what's that variation, a different white cell, what does that variation introduce? And then, of course, conversations about the game design and the degree to which it yields particular outcomes. One of the things that we spend a lot of time doing in war game design is beta testing, and making sure that our game designs don't yield singular strategy sets that are going to lead you to victory over and over and over again. You really do want to try to build games that have multiple pathways through them. And so one of the things that I think is really important that, you know, both we do on the academic side and that also the whole wargaming community does is get a little bit more serious about publishing our game designs, sharing some of the assumptions that lie behind those game designs, interrogating some of the laboratory effects with our game designs, understanding that that's going to be a little bit uncomfortable and people are going to say, you know, hey, Andrew, your game has this problem. But ultimately, the way that I think that we get better is if, you know, folks say, hey, Andrew, your game has this problem. I tried it this other way, and this is how it ended up. And, you know, that's the way in which we kind of approach it as academics, because we want to make sure that everything, you know, that we are actually moving an entire discipline forward when we're engaging with it. Unfortunately, the challenge in the defense community in particular is that, as you can well imagine, a lot of the data from a war game will be classified, and a lot of the game designs are treated as proprietary. And so you're never really unpacking the degree to which your game design is yielding a particular outcome. I will say one of the really nice things about the media engagement and the think tanks engaging in this field too, is that they're doing it in the open. And so subsequently, right, we actually are learning about their game designs and learning about their data outputs, if you will. You know, from my perspective, definitely the more the merrier. You know, there have been various efforts to try to share some of the data that are emanating from war games happening in government context. But, you know, broadly, we're still not doing a good enough job of making sure that we get all that out there.
And speaking of moving forward, as the field continues to get more sophisticated, as some of these reforms or practices that you were just mentioning get further adoption, new technologies are developed, where do you see or where do you hope Wargame is heading? And again, not just in the defense context, but in private industry, in climate risk, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it continues on its current trajectory. I mean, the cost to engage in the field has significantly reduced. Even in the last 5 years, there's new online tools to spin up games fairly quickly. We hope that we can continue to kind of build sandboxes that allow graduate students and postdocs to very quickly create games around their problems of interest, you know, such that it doesn't require, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, sometimes $1 million to create a particular gaming architecture. I hope that we continue to kind of learn a little bit more about the degree to which, you know, various different game design decisions influence outcomes. We're very much at the kind of the beginning of learning about the tool itself. If you can compare it to survey experiments, for example, you know, they've had the better part of 4 decades of really interrogating how to do survey experiments the best way possible. We're just at the very beginning of having that conversation in the wargaming space. And so I fully expect that conversation to continue and to improve. And one of the things that's particularly gratifying is seeing the next generation of scholars really think hard about using this tool as a part of their dissertation, as a part of their scholarly work. And we do have this next generation of kind of scholars coming up behind some of the scholars that you heard from in our podcast series that, you know, all of they're getting trained by Jackie and Eric and Reed and others. And so, you know, that's particularly exciting. And at the same time, I think that we've seen some of the traditional wargaming players take seriously some of the causal inference challenges that are faced when they're trying to use wargames analytically. We're seeing that as well. Obviously, this conversation was reinvigorated in the defense context, but in the business context and the climate context and development context, because you're seeing the success in the use of these tools in the security context, there's kind of renewed interest in thinking about, well, how do I bring some of that back into what's going to, you know, ultimately help me? And I think there's an appreciation of the fact that particularly where you have problems that you don't have empirical data for, you're going to need to figure out new ways to create synthetic data that look a little bit different than computer-based modeling and simulation that are fundamentally limited by the assumptions that you're having to make about human behavior. And so it's a particularly exciting time to kind of add this tool to a toolkit, if you will. And again, I don't want to come off as saying, you know, this is like a panacea. And this is the only tool that we ought to be using as analysts. It absolutely is not. You know, our team is using surveys and game theory and other tools as well. But it's a really kind of interesting additional tool to the toolkit. I will say that it's interesting. Some of the longer term problems can be a little bit harder to game out. So climate has a really hard problem insofar as when I'm building climate scenarios, the slow burn of the impact of climate change can be very difficult to drive engaging play. And so often what we have to do with climate scenarios is really push people towards, you know, pretty significant proximate consequences of global warming. So that be that, you know, for example, a typhoon that has a particular impact, or particularly horrendous tornado season or fire season. That's the way in which we kind of get at climate. And so even there, I think there are really interesting questions for analysts to think about in terms of how do you build games that, you know, are able to get at kind of the slower burning problems rather than these kind of very acute proximate consequences. I mean, obviously, both are useful and important to do, but I certainly do wish that there were ways to kind of get at the slow change as being impact that comes from the impact of climate change inside of a gaming environment without having to give people approximate, you know, a fire season crisis like the type that we see here in Northern California.
I think at this point in the conversation, some listeners may be wanting to try their hand at this or bring this to life in some way. Do you have any recommendations for where members of the public can try out a war game?
Yeah, so there's a really fun conference held on the East Coast every summer called Connections US that involves both individuals and scholars and analysts that are using these games against a particular, you know, research problem and research question, but that also are interested in just in the nuts and bolts of game design. So Connections is a really fun place where the hobby gaming community that's given us, you know, things like Risk and Monopoly and Ticket to Ride and Settlers of Catan, it's where that community meets the defense and analysis community. And so that's a really fun conference if you're looking for a place to go there. In terms of reading material, the late and great Peter Perla has a wonderful book called The Art of Wargaming, where he kind of basically builds a how-to guide in terms of how you might apply and use these tools. There's a couple of other books that I quite enjoy. There's a game called The 1 Hour Skirmish War Games. And so you can actually play those with your friends. They look not too dissimilar to some of those historical German exercises that I mentioned. And so there's lots of different ways to kind of get involved based on kind of where you situate yourself in the field. But certainly the conference in Connections is always a good time.
I said listeners, but I was obviously selfishly talking about myself. So I'll take you up on a lot of those. As I mentioned earlier, the podcast is fantastic, and I encourage listeners to go check it out. But I also have to ask, I know that was the first mini-series of hopefully many. So are you able to say what's next for the Risk Calculus?
Yes, indeed. We've just finished running a major strategic initiative focused on the next generation of arms control and technology governance arrangements. And so that's the next season that you'll see from us.
Well, you'll have to come back and tell us all about it.
I would love to.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining me.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Tyler.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our theme song is from Alibi Music. As always, thank you for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.